Welcome, travellers, to the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. Slide yourself into a disassociative fugue, and let's begin.
Welcome, traveller. You're back with us on the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. It's a pleasure to be here with you. My name's Adam Horwitz, and alongside me is the lovely...
Phil Young.
The lovely Phil Young. And today's story...
The gun.
The gun. Blam, blam. The gun. Now, do we know anything about this tale? What year was this done in?
Presumably in 51 or 52, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so it was published in 52. Not sure when it was written.
At the height of the atomic craze.
The atomic craze... Has that craze ever lost its gold?
It's lost its romantic.
It's lost the romance. Yeah, that's true.
It's so funny how we don't talk anymore. The Atomic Age was great. I used to love the Atomic Age. It gave us Astro Boy, for example.
True, true, true.
It gave us a lot of... The Blob.
Blob. And all those radioactive, you know, mutants, superheroes.
The Day the Earth Stood Still. It was a heady time for science fiction, actually.
Yeah.
The 50s. Fear of a new power. And also the promises of a clean and abundant energy source. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And so that's the time when The Gun was written. The 52. 51, 52... But we're not on Earth, are we?
No, again, we're in space.
We're in space, and we're floating around. And similar to last week, we have a crew. They seem to be on a little bit of a mission. There was an explosion. And they've come... It was a long way away from Earth, and they've come to investigate.
They seem like an exploration team. There's an archaeologist and a biologist and a chief navigator.
Yeah, and I know the biologist is very... He's keen on finding legumes. He's hoping that, you know, they're going to come across some tasty lettuce, a cos, an iceberg. Yeah, they're running out of resources. They basically were on Earth. They saw a massive... Massive flash on the sky, like so massive that there's a star system that they never knew existed, and but they've got the resources to go and check it out and see what on Earth happened, and you know maybe they're stretching their resources a bit and that they are hoping that they're going to find something that they can eat, and you know I think they can synthesize some things, but it's going to be a struggle. So they're kind of half going to check this place out. And half hoping that there's going to be something that will sustain them for the long journey back once they have checked it out. So that's the scenario. And when they get to the planet, it's not looking good.
He saw a vast expanse, an endless surface of grey, stretching to the edge of the planet. At first he thought it was water. But after a moment, he realized it was slag, pitted, fused slag, broken only by hills of rock jutting up at intervals. Nothing moved or stirred. Everything was silent, dead. I see, Famar said, backing away from the eyepiece. Well, I won't find any legumes there. He tried to smile, but his lips stayed unmoved. He stepped away and stood by himself, staring past the others. I wonder what the atmospheric sample will show, Tant said. I think I can guess, the captain answered. Most of the atmosphere is poisoned. But didn't we expect all this? I don't see why we're so surprised. A fission visible as far away as our system must be a terrible thing.
They found themselves on a cold, unforgiving rock.
they found themselves in a wasteland of sorts. There's remnants of buildings here. It seems like there was a civilization at some point, but it also seems like they can confirm that some kind of atomic explosion has taken place, and they're wondering if there's much point in looking any further.
And they're also motivated by what my friend describes as hangxiety. Hungry and anxious at the same time. Well, they're on a shoestring. It seems that everything is precious on the ship. They are worried about the oxygen that's rushing out of the ship, the precious oxygen. They're low on carbohydrates because, they can actually break down stored fats into carbohydrates if they want, but that would be getting desperate. They're on a shoestring budget.
So they're looking around, and it's clear that nothing can be alive, basically. The atmosphere seems to be poisoned, the water's been vaporized, and all the land has actually fused together. So all the buildings, it's not that they're broken or in debris, they're actually fused together. And then they see what looks like a ring of dots or something different to the slag. And so Nasha, who I think she's the archaeologist.
She's the love interest.
Oh, right. Thank you for clarifying. So the perhaps unemployed love interest. I think we find out later she's quite important. But she certainly has enough clout to get excited about this formation and convince them to turn around and go and check it out, which they do. With somewhat unfortunate consequences.
They get nuked.
They get nuked. Which you would think would be fairly bad. Clearly their ship is quite superior because they don't die.
That's one continuous thread in science fiction. I think one thing that we've often come across is the downplaying of the seriousness of nukes in science fiction. We have that in Aliens, we have that in Starship Troopers, we have nuclear hand grenades in Starship Troopers and nuclear rocket launchers. We have the frivolous use of nukes on LV-426, pull out and nuke it from orbit, it's the only way to be sure. I think nuclear technology, there is something in science fiction where it creates a distance in time or in ideology when nuclear technology is regarded as just another tool, just another thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting disconnect because, I mean, on one hand you see an entire planet that's melted, fused together. On the other hand, yeah, they've just been hit by nuclear missiles and, they're not in a good place. It renders the ship completely ineffective and they're struggling because oxygen's kind of starting to leak.
In World War II, we had developed handheld nukes.
True.
We did. I can't remember what it was called, but it was a rocket-propelled nuclear warhead designed to stem the Soviet invasion, where one man would run out into the field and set off from a shoulder. Well, it was actually on a carry it on his shoulder, set up a tripod, and launch a small thermonuclear device at oncoming tanks.
Oh my goodness.
Bit of a suicide mission, I believe that one was, but it was developed.
Right. And so that technology existed at the time that this story was written.
It was, but it only became declassified in the last decade, I think. Workshop banter. That's the kind of stuff we talk about.
I'm going to start hanging around in your workshop. I like it. Okay, but not while you're testing out handheld nukes. Maybe just while you're talking about them. Okay, so, problems. What problems have we got? We've got a ship that's broken down. We've got a dead planet. It's in this condition that they notice some movement. So I think they're pretty keen for something good to be around, for something to be alive. And that's their first thought, that maybe something is still alive on the planet. In the end, they decide to go and check out this thing that's moving. And, you know, there's debate as to whether it's just an automatic thing or if it's a, you know, if it's controlled by something. But, you know, perhaps that hunger gave them the edge. And also they had to repair the ship anyway.
I wonder if we could find anything outside. Nasha went to the window. How uninviting it looks. She paced back and forth, very slender and small, her face dark with fatigue. What do you suppose an exploring party would find? Famar shrugged. Not much. Maybe a few weeds growing in cracks here and there. Nothing we could use. Anything that would adapt to this environment would be toxic, lethal. Nasha paused, rubbing her cheek. There was a deep scratch there, still red and swollen. Then how do you explain it? According to your theory, the inhabitants must have died in their skins, fried like yams. But who fired on us? Somebody detected us, made a decision, aimed a gun.
Right, so there's speculation here. There's a big gun. There's nothing seems to be able to be alive. And there's the broader philosophical thing here that when everything else is dead, a metallic weapon will survive.
And is intelligence a sign of life? What is life, example?
Yeah, I mean, this gun was calculating, clearly. Like, it managed to spot them, it managed to shoot them. You know, it's a long shot to say that it was alive, but they're intrigued. They're interested. They're going to go check it out. Hopefully find some legumes, some non-toxic legumes. All right, so they head out. It's night time.
As they're heading towards the gun, it's confided in Tance from Nasha that the captain only has a few days in him. By the end of the day period of this planet, he'll be dead, which could be any time, really. He's not in a good way, and that will result in a changing of the guard. Nasha would have to assume captaincy.
Which she doesn't really want to do, as I understand it. In fact, she wants to mate with one of the other eligible men on the ship, so that one of them can become the new captain rather than...
What's that got to do with it?
This is the question that I was going to ask.
If she's a captain, does she not get to mate?
It might be a patriarchal ship here. If she's mated, it defers to the man. It's a very curious... Let's return to this. I just wanted to put it out there because it's a confusing moment. I found it a confusing moment in the text.
I found it a subplot that was completely unnecessary, actually. And I think that's why I didn't really enjoy the story as much as I could have.
Okay, well let's... spoiler alert. You'll have a bad time with this story. But, you know, there's certainly some merits in it. And we're never going to find those merits unless we push on through. So let's leave Nasha and her political/romantic designs to one side and fast forward to them reaching the gun, which they do.
So it seems Doric is the pessimist, Tance is cautious, and Nasha is forging ahead boldly.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. So, just before they've reached this city, they uncover a sign that says Franklin Apartments.
Which could allude to somewhere on Earth. I think that's a deliberate.
So, we weren't actually told that these people were from Earth. Am I correct in saying that?
No, they're from Hungary.
Well, they're from a hungry place. Okay, so I had been assuming that they were from Earth, but this would explain maybe the strange politics of mating. They're a different they're a different culture, and they've come across a ruined Earth, which is at the very edge of their star system. And on this Earth, they've come to Franklin Apartments, which I assume sounds like it could be in America.
It could be.
Could be Australia. I'm sure there's Franklin Apartments here.
It could be in Berkeley, where Philip K. Dick was writing most of his fiction at this time.
In the ruins of Franklin Apartments is this enormous gun, which is the subject of their inquiry. And it kind of seems like it's swiveling around tracking movements.
Nasha seems to think it's alive, yet everyone else seems to think it's a sentient machine. Or, well, actually, Doll just think it's a machine. A machine to do a job. A utilitarian gun. Purely to serve a purpose.
The enemy, Nasha says. Their own race. It is hard to believe that they really bombed themselves, fired at themselves. Well, it's over with. Except right here where we're standing. This one gun, still alert, ready to kill. It'll go on until it wears out. And by that time we'll be dead, Nasha said bitterly. There must have been hundreds of guns like this, Dahl murmured. They must have been used to the sight. Guns, weapons, uniforms. Probably they accepted it as a natural thing, part of their lives, like eating and sleeping. An institution, like the church and the state. Men trained to fight, to lead armies, a regular profession, honored, respected.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a curious thing. We've got a machine that's just doing a pointless job, basically, it would seem. But what they do notice is that it only seems to be shooting things in the air, which is why they're kind of quite safe to go up close to it. And in fact, they get so close at one point that one of them puts their hands over the lens and causes it to swing ominously around. Okay, so the archaeologist, Tance, he's pretty interested, obviously. It's the ruins of another culture. Another civilization, and so he doesn't worry that the gun's swiveling around, and he goes and checks out behind it, and comes rushing back, pretty excited, saying, "I think I've found what the gun is supposed to guard." Interestingly, here Doyle brings up Myth. It's our old friend Myth from podcast number one. And he talks about the idea that most civilizations have this myth of a dragon that protects their treasure. And so it seems that the archaeologist has found the treasure that the dragon, the gun, is protecting. So, fair enough, they go down and have a look.
Every culture, not every culture, but it's fascinating that a lot of cultures seemingly disconnected from each other. Japanese have dragon mythology, Chinese have dragon mythology, the Celtic mythology has dragons.
And are they always guarding something? Is this what dragons do?
No, I think it changes. Dragons fight with phoenixes over the ball of immortality. Japanese dragons, I don't know what they do.
So, for the character in this novel at least, he's saying,
they must come from where a dragon comes from as well. Everyone has dragons.
Everyone, oh yes, of course.
Everyone's got dragons.
Oh my lord. Okay, so everyone's got dragons. Dragons guard treasure. They also note that every dragon has a soft underbelly.
It's truly universal.
Yeah, it's a truly universal myth, a universal from one's shared semantic warehouse, often gets wheeled out in prominent position, as though on the main floor of IKEA checkout. the dragon myth. And yes, the dragon has a soft underbelly, so it's also vulnerable, and they find this with the gun.
The gun's Achilles heel.
Okay, so the gun has an Achilles heel, and they're able to smash it, put it out of commission. They're also able to check and find the treasure that the gun/dragon is hiding.
Well, they discover the vault, and dust lays everywhere.
And I can tell you what's there. There's going to be gold coins. There's going to be some scrolls of enchantment. Maybe some spell books. Maybe some armor of some kind. A few potions.
Amulets.
Enchanted, cursed or otherwise. Surely what was that?
Well, I was actually envisaging something more like the ending of Raiders of the Lost Ark, with dusty boxes packed in a huge warehouse, a semantic warehouse of a collective mythology and artifacts that the Nazis had collected over their time in Africa, and where else were they? Egypt.
Well, you seem a lot more on the money, because that is fairly close to what they found. Dusty boxes, photographs. There's one, I think it says, of a guy in a blue uniform.
A cache of antiquities.
A cache of antiquities. Kind of seems like an odd treasure.
Have you been to the Surrey Hills markets lately?
Good that I had.
Oh my god.
The dragon of Sydney public transport has been... I've been unable to defeat it and get there in time. Right, a similar world.
That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it? Their stories, their myths, their ideas about the universe.
That's their semantic warehouse.
It is. I wonder if we'll come across a wub.
Maybe they're inside the mind of a giant wub who's been recently shot to be dinner, become dinner.
All these little subtle projections that Philip K. Dick always likes to play with.
Yes, I certainly didn't note that connection with the semantic warehouse on first reading, but it really feels already we're only two stories in, and there's building a very usable set of tools or ideas for exploring the way humans interact with each other and the world.
And also positing questions over the fate of humanity after someone else discovers what's left of it.
This is their treasure, Tan said, almost to himself. Here are their pictures, their records. Probably all their literature is here. Their stories, their myths, their ideas about the universe. And their history, Nasha said. We'll be able to trace their development and find out what it was that made them become what they were. Dahl was wandering around the vault. Odd, he murmured. Even at the end, even after they had begun to fight, they still knew, someplace down inside them, that their real treasure was this, their books and pictures, their myths. Even after the big cities and buildings and industries were destroyed, they probably hoped to come back and find this, after everything else was gone.
There's different responses. Nasha also says, well, yeah, and there's their history, and once we study this, we can recreate their achievements and bring them back to life and, you know, start using some of these alien technology that we can't possibly know what we can achieve with it yet. So she's actually pretty excited. She's keen to tow it all home, which I can understand.
Oh, absolutely. If I was in a foreign land and there was no one watching, I'd be looting as well.
Except the big gun. But yeah, so they've managed to take the gun out of commission. So it's quite possible to cart these memories and pictures and books and ideas away. Pillage the warehouse. And so they They do. They start to bring some. They return to the ship.
After disabling the gun, they smash it.
Yeah, and it was easily done because it only shoots things in the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they muse. When they get back, they think a bit about this civilization, you know, that's passed away, and lament that the only reason they found that it existed was because there was the bright flash of an atomic explosion.
What do you think he's getting at here? Is he suggesting that humanity will destroy itself in its attempts to preserve what it has? Is he saying inadvertently that we will ultimately destroy ourselves and no one will get to know us apart from the things that we leave behind?
Well, you know, this is the argument of Nasha at this point, is that actually, no, the civilization is not destroyed because, you know, when they've got more resources, they're going to take these things back to their planet. They're going to study them. They're going to learn about this giant winged creature, which I'm assuming is an aeroplane. I'm not sure. I guess it's one of those little details of strangeness that you take on board. So here our subplot returns. Nasha decides to take Dorlon as her mate, and he therefore becomes the captain. And so he, as the captain, is going to come back and they're going to, you know, bring this race back to life.
What I don't get is the captain gets the girl. If the girl becomes the captain, who does she get?
Yeah, I don't know. There's certainly a strange gender thing being played out. Because on one hand, she seems quite powerful, and she's seems like she's voluntarily abdicating a position of high command.
But she's also overlooking the fact that they're out of carbohydrates. That's completely missed.
She's probably on the fairy bread come down, actually, when she makes this decision.
The high of discovery.
Yeah, comes crashing down. Okay, so they leave. They're gone. The gun's disabled. They've repaired the ship. They've had to leave most of the semantic warehouse behind. They're going to come back and retrieve it at a later date with the new captain.
And you know, this is kind of...
they're going to need a bigger ship.
Yes. So there's a bit of romance here, kind of. Like, they've gone on this thing. They've discovered a whole new civilization. She's made her decision for mating. He's become the captain. There's a whole new adventure of discovery. There's going to be a new mission out. It's kind of leaves from being quite bleak. It leaves on a feeling of quite high hope. It is the feeling that I get from reading that portion of the story. But soon to be quashed.
In true Philip K. Dick style.
In true PKD style, quashed.
Down below, in the centre of the ruined city, a single half-broken detector vane moves slightly, catching the roar of the ship. The base of the great gun throbbed painfully, straining to turn. After a moment, a red warning light flashed on down inside its destroyed works. And a long way off, 100 miles from the city, another warning light flashed on, far underground. Automatic relays flew into action. Gears turned, belts whined. On the ground above, a section of metal slag slipped back. A ramp appeared. A moment later, a small cart rushed to the surface. The cart turned towards the city. A second cart appeared behind it. It was loaded with wiring cables. Behind it, a third cart came, loaded with telescopic tube sights. And behind came more carts, some with relays, some with firing controls, some with tools and parts, screws and bolts, pins and nuts. The final one contained atomic warheads. The carts lined up behind the first one, the lead cart. The lead cart started off, across the frozen ground, bumping calmly along, followed by the others, moving towards the city, to the damaged gun.
So the gun wasn't just one single sentient being, it was part of a network of something much, much larger.
Yes, similar to, you know, the human body being able to repair itself. If there's been a bit of a scratch, it seems like this system is able to become aware that something is wrong and gather the resources to make the needed repair.
Now, there's something in this story that Nasha is well aware that taking the artifacts back is going to change their society. For good or for worse, we're not sure. But she's aware that it's going to change that society. What? Their society. What happened with this society is that perhaps once a peaceful, happy nation or planet developed into something that was purely destructive, and that is potentially what they're taking home, that destructive power of the technology.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because in the photos, they were pretty happy photos, and that was not the reality. It seemed whatever it had become was a destructive force. They don't get to take that knowledge home, though. They're coming back. They're coming back to get this knowledge, and when they come back, they're going to find a rebuilt atomic gun. And I actually, when I thought about this, it made me pretty sad. Like, we've got this new couple, they've got plans, there's adventure, there's, you know, growth, there's all this promising stuff. And, it might be a bit naive, but, yeah, they're going to troll it back and it's all going to, they're going to be decimated. The dragon wins.
The dragon didn't have its kryptonite, its Achilles heel, its soft underbelly. It was part of something much larger. It was part of the destructive force of what this entire civilization became. And also that what could be considered alive and immortal is exactly the same thing that killed its creators. Or that this civilization is ultimately the gun. That's what it is.
Civilization is the gun. If there's only one bumper sticker you get out of this podcast today, that could be it.
One less gun?
Alright, so did you like this? Did you like this tale? This fable?
I didn't like it that much, actually. I thought it was kind of clumsy. I felt... After having a second reading now, I realized that the interplay between Nasha and Doric and Dahl and Tash?
No. Tal.
Tal.
The archaeologist.
The guy.
The guy.
Tance.
That's intense.
I thought there were too many characters involved, and there were too many loose ends. I think it was very loose in that, you know, Nasha embodies a wide-eyed curiosity and is the main protagonist driving the story along. There's the power play between who gets to become captain, between Doric and Dahl. Tance is erring on the side of caution. The captain gets completely forgotten.
He's forgotten. Dahl, we don't really hear from Dahl. He doesn't... No, Doric. We don't hear from Doric, the other side of the love interest.
I actually thought that whole love interest theme was a bit of a red herring. And now that I think that you've illustrated that they go home to a new life and there's a sense of hope that will be ultimately destroyed when they come back, does tie up in the end. I think that's that's where Philip was going with that. But I don't think he made it enough of a part of the story to actually matter.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I think the theme of machines, as we all know, the theme of machines becoming able to rebuild themselves and having an agency outside, that's outside of deliberate control, is certainly, to see this, I was surprised that we saw this fairly, this idea that so early on in his work. It's a fairly sophisticated idea, given that we're in the 50s.
I think we've gotten past that ever-present fear of nuclear warheads falling on us. We don't have propaganda like the duck and cover.
Now we just have power stations that are collapsing.
Yeah, so we've tamed that dragon to a degree, I think.
Hold on to that hope, Phil. Hold on to that hope. There's certainly less urgency that I know. Even as a child growing up in the 80s, and the whole idea of nuclear warfare was a lot more in the front of my mind.
I was completely terrified. The films like Threads, or The Day After, Where the Wind Blows, they were all completely horrifying to me, and I used to lie awake at night thinking, is that aeroplane going to drop a bomb on me?
Right.
And now I think we've gotten beyond that. I think we're more afraid of each other than we are the faceless specter of a nuclear holocaust. I think we're more afraid of the lone guy on the aeroplane.
Yeah. Hmm.
But yeah, I think the story illustrates some interesting things about humanity and its directions, and whether or not our preoccupation with warfare and defense is ultimately going to be our downfall. He doesn't marry the two concepts up terribly well, though. The idea that we're archivists and that we've preserved all this knowledge and culture for someone to benefit from, even though we're going to kill that someone, whoever that someone is. It's contradictory, and maybe that's why I didn't really enjoy this story. It's that I couldn't actually process the contradiction that he was actually trying to get at.
Yeah, it's an interesting contradiction. When do you imagine the planet as one organism? In which case, below the gun is that semantic warehouse, but the planet itself can't interpret that knowledge anymore. So there's a real, it's like a cataclysmic mental event where messages from, you know, from memory are blocked from the rest of your body. It's almost an idea of mental illness through technology. There's some meat to be had in here. But yes, very very confusing. A lot of loose ends. But that was the gun. You might think differently. You might love it. You might hate it. You can certainly let us know about it at pkd@weirdfictionrecords.com, and or through our Facebook page. Come visit us, the Philip K. Dick Philosophical Podcast. Next week,
The Skull.
The Skull.
We hope to join you. We hope you join us to read that.
It's an interesting tale, The Skull. We'll catch up with you next week and talk all about it. Until that time, try not to blow yourselves up.
Goodbye.